What if the biggest threat to your financial freedom isn't, a sudden market crash, but actually your own perfectly logical attempts to time it?
Oh, yeah, that is the trap right there.
Right. I mean, we constantly hear the noise, the trending stocks, the macroeconomic doom scrolling, the rush to find the absolute perfect moment to jump into the market.
Like trying to catch a falling knife.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But trying to outsmart global finance with instinct alone is, well, it's a structural trap. So welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are moving past the beginner concepts to construct a highly specific, step-by-step mental framework for informed investing.
Because you really need a framework, right?
Absolutely. And we are breaking down an intricate set of notes drawn from the Osol Gamma investment platform and the Gamma blog. We're specifically focusing on an excerpt titled Principles and Strategies for Informed Investment Decision-Making. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the central thesis across these sources is that investing at a high level is never just a, a one-size-fits-all gamble.
No, definitely not.
It is a deeply personalized, mechanically sound strategy built around your individual psychology.
Yeah, and I mean, since we all know the baseline reality that holding your wealth entirely in cash just means you're quietly bleeding out your purchasing power to inflation, right?
Yeah, inflation is relentless.
It really is. So the real question these sources pose is how we actually engineer our specific entry into these volatile markets. And before we can optimize portfolios or, analyze geopolitical shifts, we have to establish the anchoring mechanism of the entire
Which
process.
is the time horizon.
Exactly, the time horizon. The source material emphasizes that a clearly defined life goal, whether that's funding a multi-decade retirement or executing a major liquidity event, like, say, buying a property next year, it doesn't just suggest your asset allocation.
Right.
It actually dictates the underlying physics of your risk capacity.
Which makes total sense. Because if you approach the market without that locked-in destination, you're essentially getting into a car and flooring the accelerator without a map.
Yeah, just driving blind.
Right. You might be covering ground rapidly, but you are almost certainly heading into a ditch.
Yeah.
And the text points to external market influences, like shifting interest rates, new technological disruptions, or sudden political decisions.
Basically, the act of weather you have to drive through.
That's a great way to put it, the weather.
Yeah.
But how do we actually map that time horizon against those external shocks? Like, if I know I need capital for a major purchase in 12 months versus, say, 30 years, how does that fundamentally rewire my exposure to the asset classes outlined here? Like equities versus bonds or real estate.
What's fascinating here is that time actually equals the mechanical capacity to absorb volatility.
Okay, walk me through that.
So the text illustrates this beautifully. If your horizon is 30 years, you possess the structural luxury of riding out massive cyclical market corrections.
Because you don't need the money tomorrow.
Right. History demonstrates that equities and real estate trend upward over multi-decade timelines, meaning short-term economic shocks are functionally irrelevant to your ultimate outcome.
So a bad year is just a blip.
Just a blip. However, if your horizon is 12 months, your capacity for volatility is practically zero.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, imagine a sudden 20% market correction in the equities market right before you need to extract your capital. It's catastrophic. That short horizon demands the extreme caution of fixed income instruments or cash equivalents. That's what insulates you from the macro trends the source warns about.
So if our timeline effectively mandates our asset choices, the natural next barrier to scaling this wealth isn't the market itself. It is our own internal hardware.
Our brains, basically.
Yeah, exactly. The text shifts from external market dynamics to a personal decision matrix. We have to measure our actual psychological risk
Which
tolerance.
is huge.
It is. How much volatility can your stomach handle before the instinct to flee kicks in? And alongside that, the text highlights the absolute necessity of mapping out liquidity needs.
Because getting stuck is a nightmare.
Right, like tying up 80% of your net worth in a 10-year illiquid real estate project is a disaster if you suddenly need cash.
Yeah, and we also have to address the mechanical friction detailed in the text, which is fees and operational costs.
Oh, the silent killers.
Exactly. The text warns investors to monitor these closely, and the math behind that warning is ruthless. People often look at a 1 or 2% management or transaction fee and think, well, I am keeping 98% of my money, so that's fine.
Which sounds reasonable at first glance.
It does, but they are fundamentally misunderstanding the mathematics of compounding. That 2% fee isn't just taking a slice of your current capital.
Right.
It is actually cannibalizing the future compounding growth of that capital over decades.
Wow. Cannibalizing.
Yeah. Over a 25-year period, what looked like a tiny fee can mathematically consume up to a third of your total potential wealth. It is a negative compounding force.
A third. That is insane. But okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the text introduces another filter into this personal matrix that isn't purely mathematical. It brings up values and ethics.
Yes, that's a really unique section.
It discusses tailoring a portfolio to avoid controversial industries or specifically seeking Sharia-compliant investments. Now, conventional finance theory often screams at investors to simply chase the highest possible yield regardless of the underlying vehicle.
Right, just get the highest return, period.
Exactly. So does prioritizing ethical frameworks or religious compliance inherently alter the baseline risk and reward math, or is this primarily, you know, a psychological tool for establishing the boundaries of what we're actually willing to own?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is entirely about defining the boundaries of your personal investment sandbox, which heavily dictates your long-term adherence to the strategy.
Oh, I see. So it keeps you in the game.
Exactly. The source material doesn't frame ethical compliance as a guarantee of alpha, you know, of beating the market, nor does it frame it as a penalty. It frames it as an alignment of capital with conviction.
Alignment of capital with conviction. I like that.
Yeah, because if your asset allocation violates your core beliefs, the psychological friction makes you far more likely to abandon the strategy during periods of stress.
That makes total sense.
And furthermore, the text links this to investment knowledge. By deeply understanding the mechanics of what makes a specific asset Sharia compliant, for instance, you are inadvertently doing deeper due diligence.
Oh, because you have to actually look under the hood.
Right. You are scrutinizing the company's debt loads and operational models, which naturally filters out highly leveraged, precarious investments.
So it's like a built-in safety check. So with the sandbox clearly defined, our timeline dictating our risk, our liquidity mapped, our fees minimized, and our ethical boundaries set, we have to transition from theory to the actual mechanics of market execution.
The fun part.
Yeah, the how-to. The text provides a tactical breakdown, and the absolute standout here is dollar cost averaging.
Huge fan of that concept.
It's brilliant. Instead of hoarding a lump sum and trying to guess the absolute bottom of a market dip, you deploy a fixed amount of capital at rigid, regular intervals.
Just steady, mechanical buying.
Right. I look at dollar cost averaging not just as a defensive measure, but as a psychological hack that weaponizes market volatility in your favor.
It entirely removes human emotion from the act of purchasing, which is exactly what you want. By deploying that capital blindly on the first of every month, you are mathematically guaranteeing that you buy fewer shares when the asset is overpriced.
And more shares when it's cheap.
Yes. You are turning days of extreme market panic into an automated, unemotional bargain hunting operation.
That's incredible. Like an automated subscription service, but for wealth.
Precisely. And the text pairs this with the concept of structural diversification. Mixing growth strategies like aggressive tech equities with income-generating assets like dividend stocks or rental properties.
To create a sort of dual-engine portfolio.
Oh, exactly.
But I need to push back on a seemingly massive contradiction in the source material regarding this exact execution.
Okay, let's hear it.
In one section, the text explicitly instructs the investor to sit tight during market downturns, to do absolutely nothing and just be patient.
Right. Very common advice.
But a few paragraphs later, it introduces a rigid rule to review and rebalance regularly. Like if a specific asset class explodes in value and skews the portfolio, we are instructed to actively intervene.
I see where you're going with this.
Yeah. How do we reconcile the instruction to sit tight and do nothing with the mechanical demand to actively review and rebalance? Feels like opposing advice.
It looks like a paradox on paper, for sure, but it is actually the delineation between two entirely different forms of discipline.
Okay, explain that.
Well, sitting tight refers strictly to emotional discipline. Mm-hmm. When a geopolitical crisis sends the market down 12% in a week, your biological instinct is to liquidate everything to stop the pain.
Oh, panic selling.
Exactly. Sitting tight means recognizing that short-term volatility does not invalidate your long-term thesis.
Right.
You do not touch the portfolio out of fear. Rebalancing, however, is structural discipline.
Structural. Oh.
Let's say you engineered a portfolio that was 60% equities and 40% bonds. Over a 5-year bull run, those equities grow so rapidly that they now constitute 85% of your net worth.
Which sounds like a good problem to have.
It does. You haven't done anything wrong, but your portfolio is now mathematically exposed to a level of risk you never originally authorized. Rebalancing is the unemotional, mechanical act of selling off portions of those winning equities and buying more bonds.
It forces you to do what human nature hates, selling high and buying low.
Yes, exactly, thereby resetting your exposure back to your original blueprint.
So what does this all mean? We're using dollar cost averaging to build wealth and rebalancing to lock in the architecture of that wealth.
That's a great summary.
But then the source material pivots aggressively to the single greatest threat to this entire system, which is unmanaged downside risk. And the absolute cornerstone of downside protection is the concept of diversification.
Spreading it out.
Right. You don't just spread capital across different companies. You spread it across asset classes, distinct industries, and even different global economies.
Yeah. So no single localized failure can zero out your net worth.
Precisely.
And the text offers a phenomenal stress testing mechanism for this. Before deploying capital into any new vehicle, the investor must rigorously ask, what could go wrong, and what would it take for this investment to fail entirely?
Well, I like that. Going straight to the worst case scenario.
It forces you to look past the marketing prospectus and analyze the actual failure points of the business model. This directly connects to the source's subsequent warning. If you cannot mechanically explain how the asset generates its revenue, do not allocate capital to it.
Because complexity is often used to mask systemic risk.
Exactly. Oh, and never ever put emergency savings into long-term investments. That's a hard rule in the text.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I want to challenge the text perspective on the psychological reality of that risk.
Okay, challenge away.
The source states that if you are a naturally anxious person and every market correction causes you acute psychological distress, your overarching strategy needs to reflect that lower tolerance.
Right, dialing down the risk.
But isn't some level of intense anxiety simply the unavoidable price of admission for high-yield, aggressive growth? Like, shouldn't a sophisticated investor just learn to compartmentalize that anxiety rather than neutering their potential returns to accommodate their nerves?
This raises an important question about behavioral finance versus theoretical finance.
Okay.
The source fundamentally argues that theoretical yields are entirely irrelevant if the psychological friction causes a breakdown in execution.
Irrelevant. Really?
Yeah. I mean, if your portfolio is designed for maximum yield but induces panic, you are statistically guaranteed to capitulate during a severe downturn.
Right. You end up selling at the bottom.
Exactly. Selling your assets at the absolute lowest valuation. The text embraces the philosophy that a mathematically suboptimal portfolio that you can peacefully execute for 30 years.
Oh, I see.
Will vastly outperform a mathematically perfect portfolio that you abandon in a panic after 3 years.
Because the goal is compounding.
Yes, and compounding requires uninterrupted time. You cannot compound if anxiety forces you to pull the plug.
Wow. Okay, so to bring these broad universal mechanics into sharp focus, we need to look at how the source material grounds these concepts in immediate practical reality for you, the listener.
Let's get practical.
The text specifically highlights the OSOL Gamma platform as a real-world application of these theories, primarily focusing on its ability to offer fractional real estate investing. We are talking about entering the real estate market with a profoundly low barrier of entry, just 500 SAR.
Which is remarkably accessible.
It is. Rather than the basic pie metaphor everyone uses, I look at fractional investing more like the syndicated risk models of 17th century maritime shipping.
Oh, the old merchant ships.
Yeah. Merchants back then didn't buy a whole cargo ship. They bought 1/100th of 100 different ships.
Right. So if one sank in a storm, they didn't go bankrupt.
Exactly. Platforms like this are applying ancient risk syndication to modern commercial real estate. But does a 500 SAR entry point actually move the needle on a portfolio? Or is it just a novelty? Like, does it genuinely solve the liquidity and diversification bottlenecks for someone looking to scale their wealth?
It is a profound mechanical shift, actually. It's not a novelty at all. Historically, real estate required massive capital lockups.
Huge down payments.
Exactly, creating an enormous concentration of risk for a single investor. By dropping the entry threshold to 500 SAR, the platform democratizes the mathematics of diversification.
How so?
Well, an investor with relatively low initial capital can systematically distribute that capital across dozens of distinct properties, geographies, and tenant types.
Just like the ships.
Just like the ships. It dramatically alters the compounding timeline because you no longer have to wait years to stockpile a massive down payment while your cash loses value to inflation. You can begin generating proportional rental yields and capital appreciation immediately, layering those returns back into the market.
Okay, that is powerful. And the source material also situates this fractional model within the specific macroeconomic environment of Saudi Arabia.
Yes, the local context is really important here.
It points out the critical need to align your investment matrix with macro trends, explicitly citing the economic transformations under Vision 2030. You know, the massive influx of capital into tourism, renewable energy, and technological infrastructure.
Right. Massive structural shifts.
It also highlights the utilization of apps regulated by the CMA, the Capital Market Authority. This provides the strict governmental oversight necessary to ensure the structural integrity of these digital platforms.
Protecting the investors' capital from institutional fraud.
Exactly.
And connecting those specific local catalysts, like the structural growth in energy or tech under the Vision 2030 initiatives, it brings the entire framework full circle.
Oh, how so?
Well, in our very first section, we established that investors must grasp how macro trends impact their assets. By operating within a CMA-regulated environment, an investor can confidently deploy strategies like dollar-cost averaging into fractional shares of assets that are directly positioned to benefit from these massive national economic shifts.
You're blending the personal with the national.
Yes. You are matching the micromechanics of your personal strategy with the macro tailwinds of the broader economy.
Which honestly crystallizes the core mission of this entire deep dive. Yeah. If you take away anything from the Usul Gamma insights today, it is that sustainable wealth generation is violently opposed to the get-rich-quick mentality dominating social media.
Oh, absolutely. Night and day.
True financial freedom is engineered. It requires ruthlessly defining your specific time horizon, auditing your psychological risk tolerance, minimizing the mathematical drag of fees, and deploying capital systematically through tools like dollar cost averaging and fractional diversification.
Just a steady, unemotional machine.
Exactly. It's about building an architectural blueprint that operates unemotionally, regardless of the daily noise. So, to you, the listener, thank you for joining us. Taking the time to aggressively audit your own financial literacy is, frankly, the highest yield investment you will ever make.
Before we wrap up, I do want to leave you with a final thought to consider, one that extends past the text and into the immediate future.
Oh, I'm intrigued. What is it?
Well, our sources heavily prioritize managing human emotion, right? Using automation to mitigate panic and prevent us from making irrational trades during market dips.
Right.
But as algorithmic trading and AI-driven platforms increasingly take over the vast majority of day-to-day capital deployment for wallet institutions and retail investors, we have to ask a terrifying question.
Okay.
How will the very nature of market volatility change when it is emotionless algorithms and not human anxiety dictating the buying and selling?
Wow.
Yeah. If the machines are programmed to never panic, what happens when they all simultaneously decide the exact same asset is mathematically overvalued?